Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. My guest this week is Dr. Bernard Lafayette, who is chairman of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and a lifelong giant of the civil rights movement. Dr. Lafayette co-founded the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, also known as SNCC, in 1960. He participated in the Freedom Rides in 1961 and in the 1965 Selma Marches. He was appointed the National Program Administrator for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the National Coordinator for the 1968 Poor People's Campaign by Martin Luther King Jr. He worked closely with Dr. King and was with him just hours before his assassination. Dr. Lafayette was in Vermont recently as part of the 50th anniversary of the Poor People's Campaign. It is being marked by a new display at the Ben & Jerry's factory in Waterbury, which is Vermont's largest single tourist attraction. The display is from the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture and can be seen by any visitors to the Ben & Jerry's factory. It will be on display at the factory for the entire year. Dr. Lafayette, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you.
Let's just start with a little personal history. How did you come to be involved in the civil rights movement?
My involvement in the civil rights movement really started at an early age. I was about 7 years old. I was native of Tampa, Florida, and we lived in Ybor City, which was a multicultural and still is a multicultural area of Tampa, Florida. Well, we grew up as children there, and we had opportunity to play together and do things together. But when it was time to go to school, with school age, then we separated. And in this community, we had Hispanics. We had, like, from Cuba and Puerto Rico, other places. We also had Irish, and we had Jewish people and Italians. They all lived in pretty much in the same proximity of each other. But as children, we didn't make any distinction. But as we grew older and school age, I said, you know, instead of having conversations and playing together like we used to, we started waving at each other when we saw each other on the streets. So I had that early experience. Well, my grandmother and I were on a streetcar. They called it the cable car in those days, and we used to have to run and catch that cable car. But once we put our money in the receptacle, then we had to get off in the front and walk on the streets next to the tracks and enter the car through the back door. There was a rear door. And sometimes while we were in passage going from the front door to the rear door on the streets, the conductor would close the door and take off with our money. So I was a little boy, about 7 years old, and I used to travel a lot with my grandmother. We were really running buddies, so to speak. And so I would run ahead and jump on the steps of the streetcar so that I would keep the door open in case if the conductor started off before we got there. And I was doing my routine thing. And I jumped on the steps, and I would hold the door. But in the meantime, while my grandmother was coming to the back, she stumbled and fell. She was running. She's a pretty heavy, hefty woman. And there she was in the middle of the street. Oh, my goodness. I was trying to hold the door open, and then I was reaching for my grandmother. And with the other, and I was like 7 years old, so I was a little frail seven. You know, I didn't even wear short pants, you know. And I felt like something had cut me in half like a sword. And I remember saying this to myself at age seven: when I get grown, I'm going to do something about this problem. So my motivation for getting involved in the movement had more to do with the elderly people, because they're the ones who wouldn't have too many more years to live their lives. And I didn't want them to have to continue to live their lives having to face this kind of discrimination and, you know, injustices and that kind of thing. So I could not wait to get grown because I was ready. So I had an early motivation.
Talk about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. This was a key player in the civil rights movement. You were one of its founders. What was SNCC, and what led you to want to found it?
Well, actually, SNCC was made up of these students who were from college campuses who had participated in sit-ins at lunch counters independently. That we were all, you know, in our own geographical areas in school, like at North Carolina and South Carolina and, you know, different parts of Alabama and Tennessee and other places, Kentucky. And we had our sit-ins, as we call them, the lunch counters. And the whole idea was to desegregate these lunch counters so that blacks, you know, would be able to eat like whites at these dime stores. So we did this in Nashville. The advantage we had in Nashville is we had Reverend James Lawson Jr., who had been purposely sent to Nashville to do nonviolence training in preparation for the sit-ins. And he was actually enrolled at Vanderbilt University School of Theology, Divinity School. And he was conducting nonviolent workshops in 1959 in Nashville. And those of us who were students at the schools, like Fisk University, American Baptist Theological Seminary, Tennessee State University, and we even had students from the white universities, like Peabody and Skerritt. And we all went to these trainings that Jim Lawson offered. So our first sit-ins were actually not protest, but rather testing. Because we would go and we would have our sit-ins to see what would happen. And we were collecting data and information. We were observing their responses. And then we would then come back to the church and we would have what you call simulation.
Well, talk about workshops. What happened to you in those first sit-ins. Do you recall the responses?
Well, yes. When we had the test, they would yell at us and call us names, and they would threaten to arrest us. Well, we decided not to court arrest. So whenever we were threatened with arrest, we would leave. Because our purpose was not to get arrested and protest, but just to test the situation out. And we role played. I only thought about it many years later. What we were doing was educating our emotions by doing the role play.
You were kind of getting in shape.
Yes, because physically you could be disciplined enough to sit there and take it. But the question is, how would you feel on the inside? And that's when you hear people say sometimes, well, I lost it. You know, what did you lose? You lost control of yourself. So we wanted to make sure we stayed in control of ourselves so we could stay in control of the situation.
And did you anticipate the kind of violence, coffee getting thrown at you, being thrown to the ground? Did you role play and anticipate that kind of response that has now been immortalized, in history?
We were prepared for it. We were certainly hoping it wouldn't happen, but we had to be prepared for it. And that's why we had the role play, so it wouldn't be anything that's totally unexpected. Now, frankly, one of the biggest problems I had when I was sitting in one time in Nashville, the lunch counters, and there was a young lady sitting next to me, and this person who came up who was harassing us struck a match and put to the girl's hair. Here I am sitting here, and this girl's hair is frying. I could hear it. You know, she's sitting next to me, and of course she had some oil on her hair, and the hair was actually burning. And I frankly didn't know what to do. So, and the girl was sitting there very stoic and taking on the situation. And so I reached over and I tried to put the fire out, you know, to stop her hair from burning. And you know what she said to me? She turned around and looked at me and said, don't interfere with my suffering. And then I thought about my suffering as I was sitting there and her hair was burning. And I had to respect the fact that she had a right to also take on the burden. And we do know in nonviolence, sometimes suffering is redemptive. And it's a challenge. That's all I can say, it's a challenge. If you feel you're doing the right thing for the right purpose, and you accept the suffering for the sake of the cause in order to achieve the goal. So we learn as we go along, and I've had many situations that I can talk about on a personal level, including being kidnapped by the FARC in Colombia and being a target for assassination in Selma, Alabama. And in spite of all those things, we've been able to survive. And we've seen some remarkable change, and that's the thing.
Well, tell me about being personally tested, because, you know, when we speak about nonviolent resistance and the civil rights movement, you know, we can speak in these very kind of hallowed terms as if it always happened to someone else. But this happened to you. Talk about when your commitment to nonviolence was really tested, or just how you dealt with the terror of being in these situations with Klansmen attacking you and being on the freedom rides. How did you deal with that?
Well, I had incidents on the freedom rides and that sort of thing in Selma. I guess one of the things that I can point to, I wrote a book called In Peace and Freedom, My Journey in Selma. It was about how the Selma movement got started.
And let's remind people what the Selma movement was.
The Selma movement had to do with the voter registration drive and helping people who were denied the right to vote be able to have that right and exercise that right. And those rights were protected. So the Selma movement started when SNCC, for example, decided that they would be involved in the voter registration movement. We were involved in the direct action integration of lunch counters and restaurants and those kind of things. And we decided that it was important to do voter registration. So the Southern Regional Council got a grant, and they gave the money to directors of different voter registration projects. And I was one of those who got Selma movement. And I was the director who went in and started that, because Selma was not going to be on the map. They had put an X through Selma. And I said, well, why they put an X through Selma? They said, well, all of the people we sent there, and we sent two different groups of SNCC people, and they all came back with the same conclusion that nothing could happen in Selma. And they all had the same reason, independently. They said the white people were too mean and the black folks were too scared. So I said, they said, well, you want to take a look at it? I said, no, I'll take it. If it's impossible, I'll take it. So that's
and,
right.
And we'll just remind people that this was a march from Selma to Montgomery, the capital of Alabama, as a way of bringing attention to the fact that black people were denied the right to vote, and you were trying to win the vote. And famously, Martin Luther King, John Lewis, some of the people whose names are now well known, kind of came to fame at that moment, but it ended with dogs being unleashed on protesters and, of course, is immortalized in a recent movie. Were you in the march when the dogs were unleashed?
No, actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because there's some correction here. In the Selma march, there were no dogs. The dogs were actually in the Birmingham movement.
Okay, thank you.
And the water hose and that sort of thing. But they did attack us with horses and billy clubs and that sort of thing. I was not on the bridge at that time when the first attack was made. I was there prior to that back in 1962 and 63. And the situation I was going to relate was actually in 63, when the beginning of that voter registration campaign. I drove up in front of my house one night after I left the mass meeting, and I was parked there in my driveway, and I actually was taking literature out of the back seat. And when I drove up, I saw this car across the street, and there were two white men in the car. One was under the hood, and the other was under the steering wheel. But it was not unusual to see, you know, white people going back and forth, because they live right down the street from me, so that was not a problem with seeing them in the neighborhood. But as I was getting this package out of my back seat, I heard footsteps cracking the leaves on the ground, and I knew someone was walking up behind me. So I turned around and looked, and sure enough, there was this huge guy, white guy with a crew cut hair. And his sleeves were, you know, his T-shirt rolled up on top of his shoulder. He was huge, had a lot of muscles. And I looked at him, and I had to lift my head way up because he was so much taller than I was. And he looked down at me, and he said, "Buddy, how much would you charge me to give me a push?" Oh, he wanted a push. I saw the car over there, so I assumed they had car trouble. So I said, "No problem." I closed my door and drove up my car. I had a 48 Chevrolet, so it had high bumper guards. So we had no problem pushing the car. But he was standing up there, and then he stooped down and looked at the bumpers. And I said, "Do they match?" He said, "Well, you ought to get out and take a look." So I quickly jumped out. It was late at night. And no sooner than I put my head down to look at the bumpers, he hit me. And I went flat down on the ground. And he hit me again in the head. And I stood up again, and I looked at him. And the third time, he came in front of me and jumped up and hit me in the center of my head. Just the top of it, and the temper. I went down again, but then I struggled up, and blood this time was all in my eyes. But I knew where he was, and I looked. And I noticed that he got nervous, and he started shaking, and his hand started shaking, and he had a gun. I didn't know he had a gun. Oh, my goodness. He was going to shoot me and kill me right there. So I wanted someone to witness this. And my neighbor upstairs over my house was a banister, you know, and a porch upstairs. And he was a light-skinned fellow. We used to call light-skinned, you know, black folks Red. That's a nickname. So I said, "Yeah, Red, Red, Red." So I turned my back on the fellow who had the gun on me. But Red came across the banister with a rifle. He had been in the military in Vietnam and Korea. And I said, "No, Red, don't shoot." So I blocked. Every time Red tried to get a beam on this guy, I blocked him, and I wouldn't let him shoot, okay? Now, in nonviolence, you're always concerned about your opponent, and you care about your opponent because your opponent is a human being. And whether you know it or not, we're all, as human beings, we're brothers and we're sisters. We come from the same basic roots, and we have the basic, you know, characteristics, and we must learn to love each other and care about each other and support each other. And I was protecting his life, even though he had drawn the gun on me to take my life. And every time Red would try to get a beam, I would block. Now, it's not impossible, but it would be very difficult for a person to shoot you if you were trying to block and shield someone from killing him. So in nonviolence, you give your life in order to save your opponent, even.
You're listening to the Vermont Conversation. We're speaking this week with Dr. Bernard Lafayette. He is a giant of the civil rights movement. He worked with Dr. Martin Luther King and led the Poor People's Campaign that Dr. King founded. Dr. Lafayette, let's talk a little bit about Dr. Martin Luther King. You know, you worked with, and you yourself are, you know, one of the very charismatic leaders of the civil rights movement. What made Martin Luther King stand apart? You saw him up close. What was the effect that he had on people that you saw that made him the leader that he was?
Martin Luther King was unusual, and I've met many people in my lives, and I have to say that, yes, he was, as people perceived him, he was unusual. Several characteristics. Number one, he was down to earth, even though it seemed that he was, you know, projected as this huge, you know, leader and that kind of thing, et cetera, and he was. But on a one-to-one situation in small group, when he was not doing his public thing, he was fun to be with. He used to shoot pool, tell jokes. In fact, Martin Luther King's job was when we had to travel at night from one place to another, and we didn't have places to stay sometimes, so we used the evenings as travel time. Martin Luther King's job was to sit in the front seat and tell jokes so the driver wouldn't go to sleep. Because he was so full of humor, and he would mimic people and stuff like that. So he was fun to be with, but you never forget, not for one moment, that you were in the presence of someone special. And what was special about Martin Luther King? One, he really loved and cared about other people. Not people that he particularly personally knew, you know, like family and friends, but he was concerned about all people, regardless of, you know, who they were and where they came from, human beings. He really had a love to the point where he was willing to give his life. And he would often say, you know, unless you have found something that you believed in or cared about to the extent that you were willing to die for it, then you didn't live. You've not yet lived until you found something in life that's so dear to you that you're willing to give your life. And he gave his life in many ways. He gave his time, he gave his efforts, and he gave his blood because he believed in the condition of people and that all people should be treated equally and should have the best in life. And that's what he tried to do, make things better for people so they would be able to enjoy the few years that they had to live, because we don't know how long we're going to live. But Martin Luther King always said, it's not how long you live, it's how well you live. And your worth in life depends upon how much you're willing to give, not take. So your value becomes in giving. So he believed in nonviolence, so he tried to do everything he could to bring about the changes without using any kind of violent forces. And I know many people felt, you know, strongly about self-defense and that kind of thing, etc. But Martin Luther King stuck to his philosophy and his commitment to nonviolence all the way, and I was with him his last days there in Memphis. Well, actually, I joined the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which is an organization that I'm chair of now, chairman of the board. But I wanted to help Martin Luther King, but not necessarily join the organization as a staff person. I was working for the American Friends Service Committee, the Quakers in Chicago. Martin Luther King said, no, I want you to come to Atlanta. We're getting ready to reorganize. And I said, well, can you give me a job description? So he said, yes, you come down here and write it. But anyway, he made me the national coordinator for the Poor People's Campaign.
So let's take a break right there. And we're speaking with Dr. Bernard Lafayette. He has been a lifelong civil rights leader, worked with Dr. Martin Luther King, and was head of the Poor People's Campaign founded by Dr. King. You're listening to the Vermont Conversation. We're going to take a short break for the news and talk more about the Poor People's Campaign with Dr. Lafayette when we come back. Stay tuned.